Hello and welcome to the Four Press Podcast, presented by GolfWeek.com. I'm your host, David Dusek, and this week I'm joined by New York Times bestselling author Tom Coyne. If you're one of those people who's really into golf course architecture, design, you gobble up those lists like the Golf Week magazine Top 100 that you can play and all the other Top 100 course lists, this is going to be a podcast for you. He is the author of a course called Scotland, as well as a course called Ireland, and he's got a new book out that I'm sure is going to be another hit, a course called America, 50 states, 5,000 fairways, and the search for the great American golf course. I had a chance to get an advanced copy of it, and it's fantastic. So Tom and I go pretty deep onto what makes golf courses special, what makes them memorable, how do you actually define a great golf course? We talk about specific places. I tell him where I'm willing to die on a lonely hill out in the Monterey Peninsula, and I think he's willing to let me go out there and do it. He has a different opinion than I do, but that's fine. Then we get into some of the real cool parts of the book, which touch on a lot of big themes and a lot of different things that I think people are really going to enjoy. So sit back, relax, and enjoy Tom Coyne. And now making his first appearance on the Four Press Podcast, I would like to welcome Tom Coyne. Tom's name probably sounds familiar to a lot of you folks. If you have gotten into golf course architecture, design, if you like golf travel, he is the person who is behind a course called Scotland, New York Times bestseller, which every time you probably hear your name, New York Times bestselling author, that's got to kind of be pretty cool. I would imagine this is a good thing. Do you chest puff up a little bit? You know, it's the Philly kid makes good and New York Times bestselling author here.
I've been called far worse things, my friend, and it's not bad. So it's on my business card, my golf clubs, golf bag stuff. You know, I try to be modest and humble about it. No, it's very cool. And
I think the painting on the side of the house was a little bit much, but
what? I mean, it's a beautiful font. It's been a great ride. I mean, the Ireland and the Scotland books, like I just think of sort of surprised. Ireland was a big surprise, and then that many people were interested in Lynx golf abroad, and then certainly Scotland found its place. So good to be here, and thanks for having me on.
Good. I was fortunate enough. I'd heard about the book obviously coming out. This is not a secret by any means. Now coming out on the 25th of May, you can pre-order on Amazon and everywhere that books are pretty much sold. A course called America, 50 states, 5,000 fairways, and the search for the great American golf course. And I, to start with, thoroughly enjoyed going through this book. I really liked it a lot. I think that you, in a lot of ways, struck on a lot of themes and a lot of different things that are kind of quietly percolating in the world of golf beyond the PGA Tour, beyond the sort of world of competition. If you're looking for that kind of stuff, you're not going to find it, a whole lot of that. This, to me, is much more about the game that the collective we being most Americans, play. And what we do, what we enjoy, what we sort of seek out. And I think that you nailed it. So congratulations on something that I'm sure is going to be extremely successful.
David, thank you so much. I think I like the way you sort of phrased that, a wee book. I was describing it to someone else the other day and called it like an us book. So our pronouns are spot on. The Ireland book where it's sort of like, can I just survive it? And the Scotland book like is a very sort of, in some ways, a personal sort of golf journey. And but the fun of doing America, is all the sort of people that sort of came into my path and the way I got to see the way that they play, the way that they live, the things they care about, what they're into. So, hopefully I was able to, tell that story of us, a big, complicated, spread out, vast us.
Yeah, it's so the book itself follows something, not to sort of diminish the work that I know went into this, something of a template, which you have established, which is going to different venues, taking a look at different golf courses and having a couple of different themes that sort of string things together on this journey. And as my English professors at St. Lawrence University used to love to tell me, like, look for the journey, look for the narrative, try and find this other stuff. And it's in some ways subtle, and in some ways it's very, very apparent. But talk to me a little bit about the process of which you went through going through and planning out this book. Because as you and I talked about before we started this, you start in May 19, you finish in December of 2019, right before the world basically goes to hell in a handbasket.
Yeah.
But the logistical challenge of traveling the United States to look for the Great American Golf Course, to me, is, as you sort of said, a much bigger job than going around Scotland, going around Ireland, where geographically you just have less territory to cover.
No doubt about that, and I learned that pretty quickly. This is a big country, much larger than Scotland and Ireland. So the process of putting it together, it was unwieldy. I mean, this was by a wide margin the toughest of the three to arrange, and for a list of reasons. You know, obviously we mentioned the size, the scope of the country. If you're saying going to Golf America, okay, I'm going to play all 50 states. That seems like a good way to start. I wanted to play every U.S. Mm-hmm. Open venue because I felt like if I'm playing all the U.S. Open courses, that at least gives me some tent poles of courses that I have to hit, because that's what I'm trying to do. But also from a writer's perspective, if I played every open course, then I was in some ways sort of walking through a good portion of the history of golf in America, right? With the USGA's story and how it starts is a chance to tell a lot of this history of golf in America, and that was something I wanted to do in the book. So those were some of the parameters. Plus, I asked for recommendations for courses from, you know, I crowdsourced it from the internet and got 800 recommendations of courses I had to play or else my book was going to be terrible, and worked that into a spreadsheet. And, I mean, it, you know, the trip itself took 8 months, but the planning and the arranging was well over a year. And that would be because, you know, trying to, one, whittle that list of 800 down to some manageable number. But two, this other sort of complicating factor that we have about our golf in America, and that's that half the courses were private, some extremely private, and that I knew nobody there. So that complication was very different than the Scotland and Ireland books, which
yeah.
Every course there has visitor tee times and was happy to have come share their golf course, you know. So when I say, all right, well, you know, Chicago Golf Club, I have to go there. They hosted a U.S. Open and or Shinnecock, and you know, these are tough tee times, and so you'd arrange this itinerary, and there'd be all these sort of pieces to it, and then you'd find out, okay, well, I don't know anybody at this golf course, or they have a member guest on, or they're aerating, and then the whole thing falls apart. So trying to arrange these itineraries where I was playing 36 holes a day and not, you know, I could arrange the itinerary and then not know if I could actually play the course. So that was challenging. But like you said, I mean, you had good English professors because I just wrapped up my semester here at St. Joe's. And that's something that, you know, we talk about a lot in storytelling. I just taught my screenwriting course, and that course is all about, it is all about a journey, right? Every story has a, mm-hmm. has a beginning, end, and a middle. And, what I love about what's been successful or for me as a writer, why I've gone back to this template, if you will, in different ways. The mm-hmm. three books are all very different, but
yes.
This idea of, I love the journey story, you know, because it gives me a beginning, it gives me a starting point. I get to tell the middle is where all the good stuff is, and then where am I going to arrive in the end? And it just sort of gives you the pieces that you need to tell a story. And with America, there were a lot of pieces. There were a lot of golf courses. 300 rounds was, you know, it was a good 8 months. It was a good trip.
I bet. How did you, and without getting overly personal, but you touch on it in the very beginning, how do you even bring this up to your spouse? It's not like, you know, you're a 25-year-old guy who can pack up your bags and, you know, become like this guy who's basically going to live out of a Sprinter and just sort of vagabonded around, which is now, as you mentioned in the book, being done by some people very successfully. How did you try and balance out any semblance of family stuff and those kind of obligations, which are real, with what this professional obligation was going to be?
Yeah, no, that I am not that guy anymore. I am reminded of that from time to time, that I am, you have two kids here and a wonderful family. So, you know, I talk about it in the book a little bit, but it is this notion of like Well, one, let's just get it out there. Allison is a saint and wonderful.
The little blue box that you must have had to purchase at the end of this thing. It better have been pretty good, let me tell you.
It wasn't very little, David.
It was a big one.
She's awesome and has just been supportive of this from the start. And it would be different. I think sometimes folks would read these stories and then just sort of put their circumstance into it and say, all right, what if I went and asked my spouse tomorrow to leave for 8 months to play golf? That's insane. And I would agree with you. That is insane. Don't do that. It's not smart or safe. In my case, I've been doing this for quite a while. And I would say that not only is Allison accustomed to it, she does know that this is kind of part of how I'm wired and also kind of part of my job, I guess I could say, you know, I do it for the kids, David. Do it for the kids.
It's everything for the kids.
So the, you know, doing Paper Tiger, right? I'm away for 550 days, which is actually the first time that I met you down at Dr. Jim Suddy's place.
I was thinking it's around 2003, 2004.
Yeah,
somewhere there.
Exactly. I was doing Paper Tiger, trying to play, you know, next level golf. And in that book, played like, you know, 550 days in a row and was on the road constantly and or away constantly. But we weren't married then, so things were different. So then I do Ireland. That's 4 months away when we were married, but no kids. So you're like, it's the fun phase. Like, yeah, go to Ireland, stay there. You've
basically like upped the ante like a little bit. But when you've got all the chips pushed in, two kids, your job, her job, upkeep of the house. I mean, you know, as somebody who just had a central air conditioner had to get replaced, and I'm looking at a hot water heater, like stuff is happening constantly. If you've got kids and if you've got a house, you have no weekend that basically doesn't involve Home Depot and the grocery store multiple times. And when you're a single parent, and in fact, not to make you feel guilty, but it's a lot. Yeah, as you acknowledge, it's a lot.
It's a ton, and I tried to arrange it where I was coming home. Well, we had a lot of help from in-laws, and it took a village.
Yep.
Not going to lie to you.
Yep.
With me being away this much. And then we tried to, I broke the country up into like 11 chunks or 12 chunks. And so I would do like the Pacific Northwest and then fly back home for a weekend and fly back out. And basically I'd come home and change light bulbs. Like you said, like the things that
Mr. Handy,
you know, the handy, I'm not that handy, but there's an array of things that don't get done if I'm not here. So I would do that list of things and then, you know, kiss my kids and wife and be back on the way. So, so we managed it. And once you get into a routine of it, it's not a great routine, but it's just, you get used to it. And, I mean, it's not a great routine for them. I'm, you know, living a golf dream. So it's, you know, there are things about it that aren't always super fun, but I will not complain about any of it. But you know, they made it happen.
Let's create a couple definitions here before we start getting into the book itself, some of the courses and some of the adventures that you have. What makes for the Great American Golf Course? What was it in your mind that you were looking for?
That was one of the things I had to sort of discover, right? And ask people about and investigate, because, you know, your publication does a great job ranking courses, telling you which is, you know, the best, and uses a specific criteria. And I think that's all fantastic and smart, and it's great and great metrics, and love those lists, and, you know, for conversation and debate. But I wanted to sort of find out, okay, personally myself, you know, what are my metrics? What's my list? Where do I put things? And, a lot of it has to do with, you know, that excitement factor of, if you told me that I got to play, you know, give me two courses and say you could play such and such or such and such tomorrow, my gut is going to tell me which one I prefer, right? The excitement of like, okay, for this one, I would cancel a podcast with David. This one I would not. I would not cancel a podcast with you.
That would be Meatloaf Mountain National in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. Tom's there, and this phone call, and this never takes place. But I think that you hit it though. Is that whether it's Golf Week, Golf Mag, Golf Digest, any number of different online publications, when you get rankings, you set up criteria and you go through it. But a big part for me as a Golf Week, you know, magazine course rater, the highest honor that I can sort of bestow, and we go through and there's a series of criteria and sort of, you know, scoring things and doing very subjective things. when I'm having conversations with friends and they're asking me about courses, the biggest compliment I can give a place is I can't wait to go back, and I didn't really want it to end. And there are certain places where, to me, it's just ride is fun, and I don't really care where it falls on somebody else's list or this or that. Like, this particular place, to me, is so fun to play that I'm really looking forward to the next time I can do it, hopefully tonight, you know, that kind of a deal.
Exactly.
And it sort of sounds like we're on. So let me put it to you this way before we get into the book. One of the debates that I have with some of my friends and different coworkers that I've had over the years, let's talk about, for example, at Pebble Beach. I am somebody who has a lonely flag. I don't think it's too lonely, actually. For me at the resort, I'd take Spyglass over Pebble Beach Golf Links, which to some people would be sacrilegious. And I understand that Pebble has tremendous history and the U.S. Opens and all that stuff. And the views are, you know, as striking a place as you're going to probably find on Earth. It's just gorgeous. Every time I've walked off Spyglass Hill, I just have this big permagrin on my face, which doesn't mean that I don't love having that chance to have somebody else pay for me to play Pebble Beach at that rate. but when you look at big resort places, where do you fall, for example, on that one?
I think I'm going to have to leave you on that hill alone, David.
All right. I've
you
been
know?
On that hill.
And you want to be on that hill alone, I think. It's a good...
You need me on that hill.
So I did Pebble on this trip, and I've done Spyglass on another trip. And so this was my first time playing Pebble when I did it for the book. And I had some of that baggage of like, oh, it's going to be too expensive. It's not as good as people think. The inland holes aren't that interesting. So I actually, if you can go into Pebble Beach with diminished expectations, I actually did. Of course, you know, having watched it on TV and stuff, but I was charmed from like first hole to last. I just absolutely loved it and had a fun day, got poured on. And still had fun, which is a pretty high bar when you get absolutely soaked and you still are and you're still smiling, as you say. So I'm going to fall in the Pebble camp there. But I love what you're talking about. David McClay Kidd, when I played with him at so he's in the book a couple times, and we played in Gamble Sands. This is his wonderful course, and he called it the 14th hole test. Right when you get to 14. Are you ready for the golf course? Are you kind of ready to be done? Or are you disappointed it's almost over? And I'm like, that's it. And it always does happen around 14 where you start to think of like, all right, I got X, Y, and Z to do today. Where's my phone? I got to check some stuff. This is almost over. This is great, but I got, you know. No. Or is it like I'm just trying to savor every shot because I'm just loving this so much? And I think I like that. I like that way of thinking about it. So not terribly scientific. Useful.
No, but that scene in the book really hit a chord with me. You guys are out night putting. All Caddyshack sort of references aside, there was night putting that was involved.
There was.
Sitting there, you know, eating like chunks of steak that had come off, and people are scurrying around barefoot, knocking around putts with like lights that have been strewn around. And the vibe in the scene that sort of gets depicted in that section of the book hits on something that I've started noticing maybe 3 to 5 years ago, a lot of it having been done on social media, where there seems to be a movement afoot, especially among people, I'm going to say 40 and younger, who are either discovering golf or have just sort of taken a greater interest in golf, almost in a much more organic, retro or sort of throwback isn't really it. But there is a game in its most essential part, stripped away of a lot of the commercial bits of it so that they're going to walk rather than ride many times. Music and fun and being out there, the camaraderie of it, is a much bigger factor in the experience than breaking 80 or, you know, driving the ball 300 yards, which isn't to say that they're looking to play bad golf from a score perspective. Are you noticing that as sort of like a national sort of a thing that's not just something that people put up on their Instagram and Twitter kind of stuff? But do you see that? Because it comes up as a theme throughout this book that there is this golf as being this rediscovery of just a vehicle for the fun.
The modern golfer, the youth movement, whatever one wants to call it, golf Twitter, like there's any, you know, number of ways to try and sort of classify it. But It's real. It's everywhere. It's exciting. It's healthy. It's energetic. And it's hard to measure in terms of, you know, when we talk about like the health of the game or the state of the game, typically people will revert to rounds played or country golf club memberships and golf balls, all that stuff. But that's like not the stuff we're you're mentioning there and that I'm talking about. That doesn't necessarily show up on those metrics when, because what we're talking about are, generally say the under 40 crowd who's interested in fun and experiences, right? Mm-hmm. So I grew up playing golf and I was interested, and I'm not that much older than the over 40 crowd. Let's get that out there. But I was interested in what did I shoot? You know, like what's my handicap? How am I going to do in that tournament? Can I play, maybe play in college? Am I getting better? What's my swing plane look like? You know, all that stuff. That was golf to me, and I love that, and I got obsessive about it, and it's awesome, and it's still how golf is with me. I'm trying to incorporate more of this sort of spiritual notion, and you see them everywhere, and they're usually carrying Mackenzie golf bags, and they're and with Seamus head covers, and so like, I think part of there's a lot of attachment to like small bespoke brands. New golf brands, that's part of it because they're consuming golf in different ways. They're consuming it via podcast, chat room, the internet, and they're shopping in the smaller the brand, the better. And, you know, they're making golf very personal and it's awesome. I think it's great. I think it's great for the game. And folks, you can debate about whether how sort of big this sort of movement, if you will, is. But I would say, you know, when I showed up to like Sweetens Cove, which you would say is like the mecca you know, and I had 40 people just say, because I said I was going to be there, and like 40 people show up, and they're of that variety of youthful modern golfer who's playing some tunes, who's probably not keeping score, who's just, you know, loving being out there and loving the experience. And it's like, man, this is good.
Hallelujah.
This is a wonderful way to enjoy the game. And I'll tell you what, we'll keep more people in golf if we tell them it's a good way to get exercise and listen to tunes and have fun versus telling people like, you know, this game's about making pars, because making pars is really hard.
Yes.
Having fun is easier. So I fully encourage it.
So you start the journey in the book after basically laying the groundwork and drawing out what I would assume were Venn diagrams that would have made, you know, Operation Overlord look pretty simplistic. I mean, there were probably many, many different spreadsheets and versions and all this kind of stuff that are going on. In Newport, Rhode Island, as every great journey seems to begin in Newport, Rhode Island, explain to people... what your experience was at Newport, because that to me, I'm here in Central Connecticut and I have never played it. That is one of the last of the sort of, but I never have. I've got some feelers out now. Your book inspired me. True story. I'm reading the book. I got the advanced copy of the book a couple months ago. And, I want to say it was probably late Feb, early March when your publisher was able to provide me with a copy. And I was waiting for my son, who was at baseball practice at that point indoors. They hadn't gotten outdoors, and we're very fortunate here where they were able to play baseball, which he loves. He's 16 and playing on the high school team. They've got indoor practice going, and I'm using it as an hour where I'm going to sit in a parking lot and I'm reading and I'm scribbling down notes and doing the kind of nerdy things that I do. And it just sort of occurs to me as I'm halfway through, I'm like, I've never played like this place. Oh, I've always wanted to check out that place. I had been inspired by Gamble Sands, which unfortunately, again, being Connecticut, not exactly around the corner for me. That's going to be a trek. Like, you're going to want to be there. You don't happen to be in the neighborhood.
Right.
But it occurred to me that I'd never played Newport. And I literally sent out and started a text exchange with a friend of mine who lives in Newport saying, please put out the feelers at some point this summer. It would be great because I can drive there and back in a day.
Yeah.
I don't need to sort of do some of the jumping through hoops. Tell me about your experience at Newport.
So the story starts in Newport, right? I mean, you got to pick the first course. And that was easier with this book than some of the others because I want it, you know, if I'm playing every US Open venue, I want to play Newport, which hosted the first U.S. Open. But not so fast, David, did it really? Mm-hmm. So that it's kind of fun, the controversy around, you know, when the U.S. Open began. I mean, there were national championships prior to the first one at Newport. There was one at Newport. There was also one at St. Andrews Golf Club, which at that time would have been, Yonkers maybe? They moved around a lot, so don't hold me to that. But, you know, where was the first national championship? And it's funny when you think national championship, it's like a dozen dudes, but nonetheless, you know, it would have been
it's the national championship.
But the problem was that Charles Blair McDonald kept losing, and and he didn't like the ways in which the game or the tournaments were held. You know, one was stroke play, which he felt like wasn't legit. There was no governing body at the time to oversee a national championship. So he sort of griped his way through to get the two sort of not expunged, but to the point where he griped the USGA into existence. And good for him. You know, I mean, people say, you know, Charles Blair McDonald, his contributions to golf, they are vast and cannot be diminished. And people say, oh, he was a belly acher, but, you know, that belly aching elevated American golf in any number of ways. So God rest his soul. But in his sort of demand for better standards for our championships, the USGA comes into existence, finally says, all right, we're going to have a national championship, one for professionals, one for amateurs, and we'll have it at Newport. And by the way, then he won. Way to go. McDonald, I think, won the amateur. Horace Rollins wins the Open. But going to Newport, is you've got a treat in store for yourself because it's such a unique setting. I mean, Newport is just a super charming New England seaport kind of town.
It's a beautiful little town. I mean, the whole thing is great. Yeah, the whole thing is great.
Love that. The Kennedy Church where they got married, all that stuff is so that's all wonderful. And then going down to the golf course, that is a very treeless, linksy feeling experience, sort of very minimalist, but just really interesting green complexes. Feels very old, feels British Isles in quality, and just loved it. But I think the coolest thing, driving up to the clubhouse, it's like this sort of French chateau almost set on a hill, and you drive up like a, you feel like you're in like Downton Abbey or something going up the pebble like driveway, and there's no other buildings like around it. Like it's not a country club kind of scenario where it's like, oh, there's the tennis hut, you know, it's just this like chateau. So you feel like you're going to a ball or something. It's really something else. And the locker room is upstairs and you go out on the stone balcony, you know, to see the whole course. That experience was awesome. George Pepper was there to show me around, who's a longtime golf writing hero. So that whole day was like, oh, I'm off to a good start. Aside from the rain, but because we got soaked. And a friend of mine, Billy McGinnis of South Jersey fame, he had made the cut to get into match play at the U.S. Amateur, I guess, in 95. That was the one when Tiger beat Buddy Marucci on that crazy comeback. So he came with me and sort of relived the 30-foot putt he made on 18 to get into match play, make it by one. And so that was cool, too. That sort of kicked off the USGA theme well.
So you leave Newport, and this is where I've got a beef with you. I'm wondering if you're going to get
what I did.
Blowback. Yeah, we'll see if you know what you did. So, all right, what do you think you did? What did you think you did wrong?
I think I told people about a golf course you didn't want people to know about.
Yeah, you know what? You and your fat lip just couldn't keep it shut. So, and this is where I'm going to be curious if you get, you know, for all the right reasons, the pushback from people. Mm-hmm. Because like a fishing spot, people find little places that they love and they kind of want to keep it to themselves because if word gets out, then all the fish are gone. You head down the road and you go to Groton and you head over to Shinnecasset.
Yes.
Which for people outside of southern New England, they're going to be like, I've never even heard of this place. And that's just the way you want it.
To
spend a day. What I thought was fascinating was, if I read the book correctly and understood, you basically just put the word out, I think either on Instagram or Twitter, one of you like, hey, going to be at Shinnecasset. And people just showed up. Which leads me to sort of two things. What was your impression of Little Shinnecasset down in Groton, Connecticut? And then Does this book get made before social media becomes a thing? You had mentioned golf Twitter before, but Instagram, I think, is actually every bit, if not more, powerful for golf being a visual medium. But what did you think of Shinian? Could you have done this book this way 15 years ago?
Well, loved Shinny. And hey, by the way, you brought it up. So now we're talking even more people about it. So now you're complicit in this whole thing.
How many millions of copies of this thing are going to be flying around? Millions.
Not billions. Like,
and I'm not the one who spilled the beans on it.
I know. I thought you were going to get after me for Fenwick for talking about that.
I wasn't. That was intentionally not even going to bring it up.
Sorry.
I was going to bring it up. I'm like, I was going to jump straight to Yale. I mean, why don't you start talking about my mom? I mean,
how many hidden gems can you have to yourself up there? Come on.
But here's the thing is that Connecticut has the reputation, rightfully, of not having nearly as many fun, great golf courses as, for example, Westchester, the southern portion of New York, and certainly New Jersey, which are all from the golden era. You take a look at the maps and you're like, oh, I could throw a dart anywhere in the tri-state area that hits in Westchester County, Long Island, New Jersey, and probably be pretty close to something that is historically significant and, as we had said, really, really fun and unique to play. You know, Connecticut just doesn't have the depth of the quality. So what little we have, being a little state, like us and Rhode Island are going to team up and probably get carpeted anytime soon. I mean, it's not, we don't have a lot of space. So those are the two that, you know, Fenwick and Shinnecosset that I'm like, oh, he did them both.
When I'm playing every state, I'm going to find them, right? If you only have that
I was
that
hoping
many.
You were going to head up to TPC River Highlands or something. Hey, everybody sees that on TV. And so that's but what'd you think?
I loved it. I mean, it was, you know, Donald Ross, right? And very, you know, and a very down to earth, great welcome in the pro shop. The fact that a bunch of locals and not so local folks joined us was awesome. That wonderful surprise when the course like turns down to the water. I didn't see that coming. And I'm like, wow, these like two holes here back and forth are they're as good
it's
as
fun.
It gets, right?
Yeah,
it's super
it
fun. Just an absolute blast. I know they lost some holes along the way to some encroachment of some sort of a commercial concern, but what's there? I just said we had an absolute blast, a really good walk. So that was just a super day out there walking with three foursomes of folks who showed up, like you said, because I put on Instagram or Twitter where I was. And your point about, I mean, this book could be written, but it's a very different book.
It's a much more lonely book.
It's a lonely book, and it's much more about travel disasters and snafus and being on the road alone and not having anywhere to stay because, you know, social media, the internet, it makes it easier and it makes it a hell of a lot more interesting in that I generally would always have someone to play with. I mean, I was in some pretty far flung places and said, hey, who can meet me in Anaconda, Montana? And I got a foursome. You know, waiting to go out, and that's extraordinary. And you know, say what we will about the downsides of social media, I experienced a lot of the upsides on this trip for sure.
Are you a trusting person of strangers? And I don't mean that in a way. But if you think about it, there's several parts in the book where you are meeting with, talking with people that you've never met face to face, that they're just introducing themselves through an electronic medium. You don't know who they are, and I don't mean to get all ghoulish on this thing, but there's an element of trust and faith that you would have, and it would seem that if they're the kind of people that are following you on social, that are responding in certain ways, that you're like, okay, I know this person for 135 characters on Twitter, and I can already sort of just get the vibe of like, this is going to be cool, and I'll meet and let's play golf.
I feel like I can get that vibe, and like you said, it's because I trust golf. I trust that if you're following or you've read some of my books, I mean, that's sort of a self-selecting process, right? Like if you read one of my books and still want to hang out with me, like, all right, we're probably going to have a decent time, right?
Yeah.
And so that it wasn't, you know, my wife gets a little bit freaked out about the fact that, you know, if I'm going out to play golf with someone or meeting someone or, you know, going to meet someone for lunch, like, oh, who's so-and-so? It's like some person hit me up on Twitter. She's like, what? You know, so she can be a little more guarded about that stuff.
Is the life insurance paid up? Are the premiums all up to date?
I know. You know, she made me get a P.O. box because she's like, it's really strange when strangers are sending you stuff to our house. So I did that. But in any event, I am trusting and touch wood to this point. It's been, it's paid off. I mean, the Scotland book, there were some straight up strangers where I spent multiple weeks with them traveling, which is a whole other sort of level of trusting the universe. Mm-hmm. And that worked out, very, very well. So I trusted in America and, you know, the universe kept putting good people in my path because, you know, one of the themes of the book, that there are a lot of good people out there.
Yep. I don't want to bore people with my East Coast bias sort of takes on many things. The book travels, as you mentioned, all across all 50 states. It's there's some really, really fun, interesting stuff. That part that we already talked about with David McClay Kidd really struck ahead with me. One of my favorite courses that does sort of somewhat fly under the radar because of the neighborhood that it's in, but it's sort of the golf aficionados give you this sort of knowing nod when you talk about it, is Maidstone. I had the opportunity to become very good friends with a guy who's the director of golf at the Maidstone Club almost 20 years ago. Eden Foster is one of the all-time great guys.
Yes.
And we did a photo shoot for one of my previous publications with Eden, where he was a top 100 teacher, still is a great instructor. And he invited me to come on out and play after we did it. And I didn't know what I was in for. I had no clue exactly what this was about. All I knew was there was beautiful beach behind, that there were some holes where we could get, when we photographed instruction back in the day, we wanted to make sure we had very clean backgrounds. You don't want to see houses. Well, check the box there. That's not going to be a problem at Maidstone. And where you could silhouette the person hitting against blue sky or at least an even background, so it's very clear to see them, check the box there too. And I have written in Golf Week before that my favorite walk, we did something for a walking issue last summer when walking, obviously for the reasons of COVID, became much more popular amongst golfers for obvious reasons. My favorite walk in golf is going from 7 green to 8 tee at Shinnecock, which is basically when you're walking up to this sand dune. And it is the beginning for me of one of the more fun little 3 or 4 hole stretches through about 13 or 14, where if you can imagine, folks who've never seen it, you can Google it. It's out there. You're basically hitting about a 140-yard shot into the wind because you're hitting right towards the ocean over a sand dune blind to this little green, to which to me is like they would never allow a hole like that to be built today. That would not – no one would build it. And yet every person who hits it loves it. Absolutely. Yeah. Like you remember that shot on 8 – and then over on 9, which is one of the more linksy type places, certainly on the East Coast of North America, that you're going to get, is that little stretch of 7, 8, 9, 10, really through 13, the last part of 3, if I'm remembering my numbers and such. What did you think about that? And also, my thesis statement is that Maidstone is very blue blood. It's been around for a long, long time. But when you're there, the vibe is as casual as you're going to find in many places. And I have found that in most instances, the places that are the most elite, the most difficult to score the tee time or to become members, they're the ones that are actually the most casual once you're there. Like if you can get yourself in, people play barefoot, there's flip-flops all over the place. The hang is very casual. Did you also run into that?
That's an interesting point, the inverse relationship between the exclusivity and then the chill hang, right? And I certainly found that, Maidstone for sure, Cyprus a little bit, like this all this intimidation of like, oh my gosh, I'm at Cyprus, and then you get there and I'm like, hey man, what's up? The caddies are
it's like as casual
as can be. Came sir off the sitting there just surfing, they're wearing, you know, it's like chill. And like, yeah, I think that's, there are some places that do live up to, I think, there that you play and like, oh, I'm nervous to play here. And you'll be nervous the whole day. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Maidstone hang. I rate that. Like when people ask me of those sort of long, of all the courses you play, like where would you like to join? you know, because I'm sure they're all going to come. There's going to be so many invitations, David. I'm going to have to decide.
You had to go with that bigger P.O. box to field all the letters and the requests for your membership.
Yeah, I know. So, but I always say Maidstone because of that, because what other golf course? One, and the golf course, too, has a little bit of everything. I mean, it's got dunes. It's got some water. It's got sort of a farmland feel that then goes through some marshy stuff, mm-hmm. and then you're suddenly in Ireland. So, I mean, the golf course has just great variety and is a joy to play. But what other course then, you know, you walk from the 18th tee and then go hang out with your kids on the beach and, like, build a sandcastle? Like, that, I've never seen that, you know. So the beach club and the golf club existing next to each other, where you can see, like, the cabanas from the golf course. I'm like, this is awesome. And hanging out in the locker room with our host, and you're right, it was super chill. I was, like, talking books with the locker room guy, and, like, I'm like, this place is awesome.
Yeah, and I remember it's been a few years since I was there, but you think, like, oh, it's got to be this, like, stately, gorgeous. Everything is, like, you know, brand new and freshly appointed. It's got everything you need in the most, you know, unsnobby way. It smells like talcum powder and, like, Alberto VO5 from the old timers. It's you know, you flop down in the big chairs. It's really casual, and you're like, oh, this is cool. I feel very at home here, and my gosh, like, wouldn't it be great to be able to play this every day? Which sort of sets me up to another question that you talk about quite a bit in the book, which is the difference between this sort of, you mentioned it coming off of Friar's Head. Somewhat of a hypocrisy that you felt this sort of inner conflict where there are these wonderful and amazing venues that you're having the ability to play and that some people in the United States get to play. Most people don't. Most people who are listening to this will never play Maidstone. They're not going to play Friar's Head. They're not going to play Shinnecock Hills and any number of different places. You go to the UK, Scotland, it's a very different thing. Anyone is free to play a lot of these different places. It's just a different take that we as the Americans basically botched this up. Do you still sort of have that sort of inner struggle? You talk about it in a couple of different places, but where are you right now in terms of the availability of the greatness of golf courses to most people?
Yeah, availability, accessibility. I mean, honestly, that is a drum that I continue to beat, and I always will. And so having come from the Ireland and Scotland experiences where I was welcomed as a member for a day at anywhere I wanted to go, and then coming here and having that experience of sort of having to play the networking game or sort of beg your way on for the chance to see courses, and incredibly thankful that I did have the chance to see all these places. But then, right, like, so leaving them and saying, like, well, what kind, I'm a hypocrite, right? Like, I champion this cause of accessible golf, and then I'm going to play courses that the 1% get to play. And, you know, what's that all about? So that was something that I do wrestle with a few times in the book. At the end of the day, if I was going to write a book about golf in America, those are the courses that, you have to play private golf clubs. That's the way it is. But I can still make the case and make the point that the fact that courses in Scotland are open to visitors sometimes all the time, sometimes for just a few hours a week, is a scheme that works very well. And it's Scotland, and they invented golf, and it hasn't diminished their experience or anything. There's a division in Scotland between club and course, where the course itself is accessible and essentially public, but the club, right, can be very exclusive. So I can't join the Royal and Ancient, but I can go play the golf course. And they're not sitting in the Royal and Ancient, like, looking through the windows thinking, like, who the hell's that on the first tee? Which is, you know, what will happen at your club in America if some dude just walks up and plays. And so I also wanted to figure out why was this the case, you know? Because it seemed like you would think England, Scotland, et cetera, to be the stuffier and less visitor friendly. Why were we like this in America? And it's interesting history. I mean, the country club movement of the 19th century was all about sort of celebrating these Anglican civility and English games. So these country clubs were set up for hunting, horseback riding, and playing polo and cricket and all this stuff. Golf comes in a little bit later, So Philly Cricket Club adopts golf eventually. Brookline gets golf. Myopia Hunt brings in golf. And suddenly golf is behind fences. And because these were bastions of places where, you know, as America, you know, America with its mobile class structure and all these immigrants, it's like, all right, well, here we're going to be civilized. And so golf in America gets wrapped up in that. And that's kind of a bummer. And we're still living in that world of golf behind the gates. So, which is so very, very different than what it is in Scotland and Ireland. And I'll keep beating that drum, David. And I think there's a way to make it work. I don't know why. I don't care how exclusive your club is on Tuesdays from 10 to noon, you could have visitors come and you could help them underwrite your club, or you could donate that money to something. I don't know. It just, I don't see what the harm in is it.
I'll stay up there on Spyglass Hill myself holding up that little flag, but I'll be happy to join you for lunch on Thursdays, you know, with that one.
Come on over.
I think it would be wonderful.
It's good hill.
Yeah, I heard the grilled cheese sandwiches with the tomato soup are wonderful. Funny story. So you mentioned, you know, the fact that you started out with Pep at Newport. George Pepper, having been the editor for 25, 28 years at Golf Magazine, right as I'm showing up, he is deciding to go on. He had, I don't know if he still has it. I think that he gave it up. He had a house on the 18th at St. Andrews. I don't know if he still has it or not, but the first time that I had a chance to play St. Andrews, in Scotland was in 2006. I went over with a photographer from Golf Magazine, an SI, a guy named Fred Vuich, one of my very best friends serving in the industry. We went to Hoylake and we watched and covered the Open Championship there that was won by Tiger Woods. And this was right at the beginning of when people were starting to get broadband. So I had pitched to my boss, hey, look, since I'm already going to be there, we know that the Open Championship is going to be at Carnoustie in 2007. That one was won by Padraig Harrington. It's sort of for the American fans, Rory McIlroy's coming out. Let's head over to Carnoustie. Fred will get pictures. I'm going to bring this video camera, which, like, no one's really shooting a whole lot of video in 2006 at that point. Right. I'm like, I'll get video of Carnoustie, and we'll have all these assets for next year's British Open. I mean, we're already going to do this. We go out there, we get it, we stay right there at the hotel. It's a year ahead of time. You've been there. There's nothing to the town of Carnoustie. When the Open Championship's not going on, you know, it's pretty much, you know, Scottish tumbleweed going on there. There's just nothing there. But I did walk on as a single at St. Andrews on one afternoon. And I'm playing the 18th, playing well. I hit a really good drive on 18, and I see a guy walking a pair of Scotties across the fairway. Now, for people who are not aware, but most people who are listening to this at this point after, you know, 45 minutes probably are, that people walk their dogs, and it's essentially like it's a public park. I mean, you can do lots of things on the grounds of, you know, the old course at St. Andrews. I hit my tee shot, and I see a guy walking from the beach back over to the road, and he kind of looks familiar, and it was George Pepper. Just totally coincidentally, it was. I'll send you the photo to prove it that my caddy took, and that was George. He sees me, he's like, Dusak? I'm like, George, how you doing? He's like, looks down, he sees my ball, which I had gotten across the road. He's like, you really knocked the shit out of that one. Good job, buddy. And then proceeded to walk right down the middle of the fairway with me and chat, watched me try and bump a 7-iron up that rolled back into the Valley of Sin. But then he did see me make the putt from the Valley of Sin, a la Constantino Rocca.
What?
For the very first time that I broke 80 was that. I went birdie, par, birdie to shoot 78 on the old course with rented clubs. Actually, they weren't even rented. They were brought down from Carnoustie because British Airways had lost my bag. So I was wearing running shoes and using somebody else's gear, which just shows you, you know, like how much value at the time, like, you know, I had in my technology. So that was my tying it all together. And as you look at the pictures, there are people sitting there behind 18 holding pints of beer, relaxing in the late evening sun, because the sun doesn't go down in July in Scotland. It basically is up 24, you know, hours a day. But I bring up the story, number one, because whenever I think of George, I think of that just total happenstance. But then it's public land. You know, people don't look at golf courses, historically significant, literally the home of golf, as we consider it. it's not blocked off behind some wall with security guards who are there to keep you out, to keep them in.
Not at all.
It is as public a venue in the middle of town as you could possibly imagine. Imagine having, you know, San Francisco Golf Club, but it was right down on Union Square in San Francisco with no shrubs, no nothing, and that's what you have. And it's, in some ways, it's very unfortunate, and I think it's tragic that we don't open up the gates, you know, to this. I think it's really cool that Seminole, over the last year with the Walker Cup that just concluded, with a TaylorMade event where they had Rory McIlroy and, you know, Matthew Wolff and some of these people. Those are the first time we were ever seeing Seminole Golf Club, you know, which a lot of people have heard, like, oh, this is where Hogan went to go practice for his Opens. This is the summer home of this and that. I'm like, and no one's ever seen it. Unless you're fortunate enough to play, like, no one's ever seen these places. Right. And so I'm more than willing to go on that hill with you. I think it would be absolutely fantastic.
It's a great hill, and it has, and it's definitely influenced by, like you said, that Scottish experience. You know, the fact that St. Andrews, the old course, is closed on Sundays so that you can walk your dog and have a picnic. It is a public park. It's a public green. And when you drive into St. Andrews for the first time, that's the thing that strikes you. You say, like, wait, that's the golf course? It's right there. Like, no, that's got to be a parking lot or something, because the golf course has to be away somewhere, like, closed off. But no, it rolls into the middle of the town. It does the same thing in La Hinch. It does up in Moray. It does the same thing. And, you know, where the golf course literally, like, kind of North Berwick flows into the middle of town, where the golf course is incorporated into sort of people's everyday life. And that's just, that's awesome. I absolutely, I love that. Great. And the Scottish are very fiercely proud of their right to roam, you know, that idea of I'm a Scot and this is Scottish land and I can walk upon it. And so, yeah, try and put a fence up, you know what I mean? So it's good.
Your book ends in San Diego, California, and it is a very unique story. And it sort of brings a little bit of closure for the reader to one of the narratives and the themes that you write about quite a bit, you know, basically understanding where the game began for your father, which really is the beginning of the game, obviously, for you and for your family. Can you describe to people, we're not giving away lots of things, but I think this was great. I loved the ending.
Thank
you. Describe what happened in San Diego.
Yeah. So it was, as I'm traveling across America, a lot of time to reflect in the car, a lot of long drives and thinking about where, you know, what am I doing? How am I out here? What's, you know, what's behind all this? And all those sort of the questions, the longer you drive, the bigger the questions get. Coming to understand, you know, the role that golf's played in my life, which is, like you said, goes back to my dad, you know, who because he golfed, I golfed. Or because he played golf, rather. People who don't like to use golf as a verb. Because he played golf, I played golf. And not that he forced me to, but I grew up around the game and he took me up for Sunday clinics to the club. And that's where I fell in love with it. He took me to Ireland when I was a kid, and that's where that love sort of grew and expanded. So thinking about him and how he came to learn golf, because he wasn't from a golf family. His dad did not play golf. He picked it up in the Navy. And it was also sort of another surprise theme of the book is all the sort of military folks that I met and played golf with. And discovering the huge role that, you know, when you grow up on the East Coast or the West Coast and don't spend a lot of time in the middle, you're less probably aware of the huge role that the military plays in so many people's lives and is at the heart of so many communities. And golf communities as well, because that's sometimes often where the golf course is. And that was the case for my dad, where he picked up golf in San Diego because he was stationed out there during I guess it was after Korea. He was stationed there and had an office gig. And on his lunch hour, they, you know, they're young guys with nothing to do. And there was a nine-hole golf course across the street from their office. And they would go, and it was on the base. And that's where they would go and smack it around without lessons. You know, without, you know, they held it like a baseball bat. And, and he still does. And, you know, 60 years later, and still plays, and we still play together. And in getting to San Diego, my mother and him had been got married while he was home on leave in Scranton, Pennsylvania. And then he had to be in San Diego the next week. So they got in the car and they drove across the country in a Ford Fairlane. And I would sometimes imagine that and think about that. You know, this was my first time seeing America, crossing it, and that was their first time that they did back in the, you know, the 1950s. And so to go back, I was on the hunt to try and find the golf course where he found golf, because by extension, it's where I got golf. And it wasn't easy to find. And whether it truly still exists and whether I did find it.
Oh, you found it.
I know. Come on. I found it. I don't want to give the reader too much, but it was
They're going to buy it.
It was a very special way to sort of close the story. And I was very fortunate to, like, it's not, you can't just walk onto a military base and play golf.
Right.
And so I found a very kind, helpful person at the Naval Base Golf Center, and nobody had heard of the. There was no nine holer on the Naval Base anymore. So
well,
I was
because you even mentioned that you had been at Torrey Pines like the day before or earlier, and those guys who were Life or San Diego people like they'd never heard of it.
They never heard of it. So I was down in the dumps, man. I'm like, ah, oh, this was how I really wanted to finish the trip and wanted to find this. It would mean a lot, and so I couldn't find it. Like no one had heard of it. And so I just started looking at like Google Maps of the military base, which is actually a good way to get yourself probably put into a cell somewhere. But yeah, found
Mr.
a green.
We'd like to have a word with you over
talk
here,
to
please.
You.
No,
please
just
see your
get
phone.
Into this unmarked black van. It'll be okay. It'll be fine.
And found a green space and looked closer, and I was like, "There's greens on this space in the middle of the where Dad kind of said it would be." And found that it was a golf performance center that most of the course had been lost to new apartments and parking lots, but they'd kept like four greens and a tiny driving range where you hit into nets. So as a place to like blow off steam for the sailors. So, you know, I'm like, all right, this must be the place, but then getting on the base and getting someone to help me out to get there, that was a whole other level of like generosity and a confluence of good fortune. To get through the gates and get the chance to put a tee in the ground and walk around and think about 60 years ago, my dad was a kid and was walking around here, figuring out golf and with no idea where his life was going to go, and no idea that he'd have a son someday that just played he played golf in all 50 states and was now here doing the thing that he was trying to figure out. So. That brought it all together to me and was a pretty emotional day.
It was a great ending to a fun book. There are also some fun lists in the back of the book because everybody does some lists. I highly
recommend
people
go out and check
it. We do love our lists. We like to quantify things. We love them stats. A course called America, 50 states, 5,000 fairways, and the search for the great American golf course. Tom Coyne, thanks very much for coming on the Forward Press.
David, thanks so much for having me.